The committee will come to order. Representative Swales, you are first on the agenda, and I believe that with this one we will set five. How long is your presentation?
I have several people who come to testify, so it could be 10 to 15 minutes.
I'm sorry?
10 to 15 minutes. No.
Why? Do you want your bill?
We'll keep it very brief.
7 to 8 minutes then for each side, and then discussion will be about the same.
All right. We'll make it as brief as we can. I'm here to move House File 1595. This particular bill permits the vendee or owner of a home to recover...
Representative Swales, we have to have somebody on the committee move the bill.
Mr. Chair, I'll make that motion.
I'm so used to doing
Thank you. Representative Kranz moves the bill for possible inclusion in the... layover for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Representative Swales, go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Representative Kranz. I owe you one. this permits the vendee or owner to recover costs, disbursements, and reasonable attorney's fees in the event of a breach of warranty on a new home or home improvement project. The reason that I brought this bill forward tonight is because I come from a community, I live in Woodbury, and we have had 500 homes that have been identified and have had to be repaired because of problems with mold inside of stucco. And we have many people who have spent exorbitant amounts of money to get their homes repaired. They have, this has resulted in health issues. Stress on families that is unimaginable, and I present this bill simply because it seems a matter of fairness for the homeowners. I'd like to introduce a homeowner right now, and he is going to share his personal story with you very briefly.
Well, my name is Ed Seifert. Thank you for allowing me to speak. I live in Shoreview, and the reason I'm here is to speak in support of this bill because I think the Minnesota Home Warranty Statute has a flaw in it that needs to be fixed. I lived through a home warranty experience that lasted about 2.5 years that I think is a perfect illustration of why the law needs to be fixed. Let me briefly tell you the story. It's a long one, so I'll try to make it short. I had a new home built in 1994 by a reputable Twin Cities home builder. 3 years later, there was a storm in Shoreview, and it damaged many homes up there, including mine. I needed new siding. I needed a new roof. I needed some windows replaced. So at that time, we had the siding replaced by a company that offered to do stucco siding. We decided to do it. We were sure that everything would be okay, and so we had stucco siding installed. In 2003, we discovered a water intrusion problem. We notified the builder and the sider. They came out, looked at it. Both of them said, oh, it was a minor problem, but it wasn't their fault. It was somebody else's fault. So we then hired experts, had two different companies come and do testing at the house. They said there was severe water damage behind the stucco. And so we shared the results that these experts gave us with the builder, the sider. Again, they said, nope, not our problem. And at that time, we decided finally, when everybody said they weren't interested in helping us, to file a home warranty claim. We actually filed it against four companies, the builder, the sider, the roofer, because we had our roof replaced due to the storm, and also the window company. And this was based on what the experts had told us could be the source of the problem. So anyway, so we started this home warranty suit against them. This was in 2004. In 2004, okay, I'm sorry. Speed it up. Okay. Well, anyway, the deal is what basically happened was we decided to repair the house, spent $150,000. Okay. We tried to settle with when we sued the companies, they all got their insurance companies involved, and the strategy that became apparent to us was that the insurance company lawyers wanted to drag this out and make it expensive for us. To give you a summary, because we ended up settling a year ago in March of 2006, we ended up spending about $206,000 in total. And of that, about 150 was just to fix the house. So we settled for 130,000. Okay? And so that means that we lost essentially about $76,000, $77,000, which we, as a matter of fact, are still paying off. So this is a consumer protection issue. If I could have collected attorney fees, we probably would have settled back at the very beginning of this whole process. It wouldn't have gone on for 2 years. Okay? And so that's why I'm in support of this bill.
All right, thank you.
Hi, my name is Gail Wilson. I'm from Lindstrom, Minnesota. I'm in support of this bill. I just found out about this yesterday, so I'm not used to speaking in public, but I'd like to share with you a following reading. Just our thoughts and feelings that we've been going through this. We're in the middle of it right now. Basically, your home is most likely the single most expensive investment in your lives. Whether made simply or not, you need a home. For most people, that's their retirement. When something devastating as construction defects happen to you, you soon learn the laws are not there to protect you. You have hired professionals expecting nothing less than their work being done correctly. But in the end, you're left with a damaged home with costly repairs, feeling that there has to be some kind of justice to do to this doing wrong. You hire an attorney and start the process, which seems to be extremely similar to everyone in the same position. To your surprise, you are turned into the victim by being the one blamed. Insurance companies hire their attorneys to postpone and fight you until you're left financially and emotionally exhausted. All the while, your marriage, job, and children seem to also suffer the cruel effects of this, not to mention what this probably does to your mental and physical well-being. The insurance companies have found a way to manipulate the system by turning the homeowner into the victim. Insurance companies are fully aware that your legal fees will surpass what you may recover, or you're left with next to nothing to work with. The homeowner's chances of coming out even whole are not likely. In the end, these families are losing their homes, and in some cases, their marriages are destroyed, and most are suffering from some sort of depression, all because there seems to be too many laws in favor of the insurance companies. Most of us are just praying for laws to start helping the average homeowner. Thanks for listening. Thank you.
My name is Scott Andreessen. I'm also here to testify in support of this bill, and I'll be very brief, and I'd like to make three quick points. Number one, I am an attorney who represents homeowners just like those you've heard from. I've represented approximately 200, 250 homeowners in the last 5 years with problems just like theirs. And I'm here to tell you that if you were to pass this law, it will not benefit me at all. I think I'd have to, in fact, find a new line of work. And that's because what would happen if you allowed attorney fee recovery for warranty claims is the cases would settle. There wouldn't be nearly as many lawsuits because there would be some incentive for the insurance companies to settle them early. The other thing that I think is important for you to consider is that this bill simply levels the playing field. Right now, under the warranty law, a homeowner has to sue a builder if there's a defect and the builder won't fix it. And not surprisingly, the defects we're talking about, that Representative Swales talks about, these are problems that cost $100,000, $200,000 to repair. No one expects a builder to dig into their pocket and be able to fix 20 of those. They can't. But there's a reason that builders are required by the state of Minnesota to have insurance. Okay? To be a contractor, you have to be licensed. To be licensed, you have to be insured. And insurance companies accept a premium to accept the risk of loss and the loss of defense dollars. And so as soon as a claim like this is turned in, it's turned over to the insurance company. The insurance company hires a lawyer under its line item budget. The homeowners don't have a line item budget for attorney's fees in their yearly budget, so they go and they pay me. And they're going to pay me an average of about $30,000 to $40,000 on one of these cases, and that's to get to the point where they can settle their case for somewhere between $20,000 and $30,000 less than the cost of repair. If you were to amend the 327A statute to allow the recovery of attorney's fees, that will change. It will level the playing field. That's all I have. Well, thank you.
Thank you. And you just hit it almost 20 minutes.
Okay.
Representative
Quayle. I have someone who is with a building inspection agency.
Well, give them like 20 seconds or something.
In brief, thank you for the opportunity to upgrade the standards of builders. My name is Ty Schwab. I'm the owner of Mold Solutions. We would be in the analogy of the general doctor that looks at the house before we send it on the practitioner or the surgeon, whatever the analogy may be. If you were to pass this bill, it would allow the surgeons the corrective strategies to be employed at a higher level. Far be it for me to tell you what the American dream is, but people are in leveraged assets. The financial implications are enormous. And to allow the consumer to have this bill passed would allow a higher level of standard building and a higher level of corrective strategies. And that's
okay, thank you. We have to keep, at this point in the session, we have to keep the things moving. And so is there any opponents that want to testify on this? I see somebody, I think. Go ahead. And then Representative Immer will have your question when we get to the question and amendment period.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I'm Lisa Furnett. I'm the Government Affairs Director with the Builders Association of Minnesota. Thank you very much. I promise to keep this as brief as possible, Mr. Chairman. I'm here to oppose House File 1595, as you probably can all imagine. First of all, standard procedure for civil litigation cases has always been that each party pays their own way unless there is a case of misconduct. At the very least, we think that the bill should allow the prevailing party to win attorney's fees, costs, and disbursements. That means if the builder was to win the case, that they ought to be able to collect on the case. I'd also like to rebut a statement that was made earlier that said that a homeowner has to sue in order to recover anything to get their house fixed. We did pass a provision last year called the Notice and Opportunity Repair Law, which allows a homeowner and a builder to come together to work before civil litigation needs to start. Thank you very much, committee members. I appreciate the time. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
That was quick.
That's what you want.
Thank you. Maybe that's what... Mr. Hesse?
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, my name is Tom Hesse. I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. And I will probably be equally as brief. We also oppose this legislation and for similar reasons. First, we believe attorney fee statute should not be one-sided, so that, as Ms. Frenette said, that both parties should be able to collect attorney's fees if the statutes so grant. We do have some sympathy with the loser pays statutes, however, but again, we think that they only work if both sides face the same incentives, and that is certainly not the case in this legislation. But I also want to direct your attention to the effective date section, where it is effective the day following final enactment and applies to causes of action pending on that date. So it does apply retroactively to cases that are already being litigated, and that is another reason for our opposition. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Is there any other opposition? Okay. I see Representative Swales. Two amendments appeared, A1 and A2. Are these yours or are they Representative Emmer's? Okay. Then we'd be through with that portion of the testimony. Now's the time for questions or amendments. So, Representative Immer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I forget the first witness's name. I apologize, but he had made a reference to the fact that the insurance company was mishandling it. I'm just wondering, there are some other provisions in the law. And granted, we're talking about attorney's fees, amending the law to include a claim for attorney's fees tonight. But there are sanctions that can be imposed by the court under Rule 11 or the Statute 549.211, that if indeed the court believes that the abuses that you referenced do occur, the court can fashion whatever remedy, whatever sanctions are appropriate, including, I believe, attorney's fees. And I'm wondering if you did that in your case.
When I spoke of the insurance companies not acting fairly, I wasn't saying that they were doing anything that was illegal. I think what they were doing was completely legal. But what I consider they were doing was what I would call unethical. And there's a difference. I mean, I can't recover anything for that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, I respect your point of view as not being a lawyer, but Rule 11 does apply to ethical conduct, and I'm wondering if you or Mr. Andreessen apply to the court for relief in that fashion.
Excuse me, Mr. Andreessen wasn't my attorney.
Oh, okay, sir.
But anyway, what I'm talking about is that what they did was not probably, from a legal point of view, unethical. But what they did was, in my case, no one disputed that there was a problem with my house and that it wasn't my fault. Okay? No one of the parties we sued disputed that. All right? But once their insurance company attorneys got involved, the strategy was do everything you can to make this last as long as you can. Okay, let's depose 15 people. Let's bring motions that don't really pass a chance of being accepted by the judge. Let's have lots of inspections. Those things were all completely legitimate from a legal standpoint, but what I'm saying is from just a consumer standpoint, because I was not to blame for the damage of my house, I consider that behavior unethical. Do you understand?
Mr. Chair, yes, sir, actually I do, since I happen to be one of those defense attorneys in my other job. And I guess the reason I'm asking is because we do have in the law right now rules and statutes in place that if in fact attorneys were misusing the legal system, you could apply to the court for relief, which would include attorney's fees and other sanctions. And I do appreciate there are always two points of view to all of these issues, and I've been on both sides. And what I'm going to suggest, and if you need to respond, I see Mr. Andreessen moving up, that's fine, but at some point I'm going to offer an amendment because I believe that what you're doing I have no problem with, but it should go both ways. We shouldn't just enact attorney's fees for one side of the litigation and not allow it for the other. The incentive and risk should be the same to both parties. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'm ready to offer the amendments, but I see that they might want to respond.
Could I just make a comment on that?
Mr. Seifert, you could comment.
Thank you. But if you were to make it go both ways, from a homeowner's point of view, here's what I would tell you the effect would be. It would be the same as if you got rid of this statute. Because I can tell you as a homeowner, if I had to assume the risk of paying attorney fees, I wouldn't have bothered to sue anybody. I would have just fixed my house, and then I would have been $150,000 in the hole. Okay? And I think that, for me, that's not unusual. I think any homeowner would probably act that way.
Representative Emmer, did you want to make your...
I'd move the A1 amendment, Mr. Chair.
Okay, the A1 amendment is moved. And do you want to...
I would, very briefly. The A1 amendment would provide an attorney fee, a right to attorney's fees to the prevailing party. And again, while I respect the witness's point of view, and folks need to remember that or keep in mind that whenever you have one of these disagreements, they are highly emotional, and they do have more than one point of view. I, however, have found from my experience that if someone believes in their case, if it's a good case, the attorneys don't get involved. It gets resolved before it ever gets that far because nobody, believe me, the insurance industry, the builders, folks like this nice man, nobody wants to spend time and money in the legal system. There is a reason why cases end up in the legal system. And if someone believes, if I as an attorney or Mr. Andreessen or anybody else feel strongly enough about a case that we would advise our client that it makes sense to proceed, then you should be prepared to accept the risk as well as the gain. If you're successful, if the other side wants to fight a claim on bad faith grounds, they're simply going to delay and cause trouble, then they should pay your attorney's fees. But by the same token, we don't need to use the legal system for the wrong purposes the other way. So I'd move the A1 amendment.
And, of course, there's 325F and those types of statutes. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to say at the outset, as many committee members know, I have a great deal of respect for Representative Emmer on these issues. We actually agree more than we disagree, and he's been a great champion. When I served with him in the old civil law committee for the rights of litigants, particularly aggrieved plaintiffs, to seek justice in court, I do, though, respectfully disagree, and I would say that if this amendment goes on, I urge everyone to vote against the bill. I agree with the testifier that it would be worse with this on there than just about anything. I think that the two-way attorney fee statute that's being urged with the A1 amendment is really a particularly cruel turn for homeowners in the situation of Mr. Seifert and many others, probably countless others around the state. And in terms of, because I don't think anyone would sue, I think the average rational homeowner, no matter how zealous he or she or they were, would not sue if there was the risk not only that they would lose the lawsuit and lose any relief and any justice, but they would also be out their attorney's fees and a big builder's attorney's fees. I don't think we'd see any lawsuits, and we'd see a lot more Mr. Seiferts who are just eating their costs entirely, and I think that would be bad. In terms of this, the argument that we've heard from time to time, not necessarily here, but elsewhere, that, you know, this is a really rare thing and this is a radical step. I know members of the committee have this excellent handout that our own House research put together in February 2004. It's 3 years old. I guess by now it's even larger, and I know that the page has made more copies for those who are here in attendance in the audience. But this rather thick document is a list of all the attorney fee awards in Minnesota statutes, and it's a very comprehensive, very thorough document of all of them, and it breaks them down by who gets them, whether they're mandatory or permissive, whether there's a limit on fees, and if so, what are the criteria. And rather than belabor the point by listing a few of the real gems in here, suffice it to say that our statute books are riddled with attorney fee awards in situations that I at least would deem far, far less worthy than this, where someone's life dream of owning a home is on the hook and where families are being shattered over these lawsuits that are, frankly, in my experience, drawn out and drawn out and drawn out so as to crush average everyday Minnesotans into powder, and that is often what happens. So the argument that we don't have these attorney fee statute awards and that we don't have mandatory one-way attorney fee statute awards just doesn't bear under the weight of the evidence. And I think this excellent summary from House Research says that. So I'm obviously strongly against the amendment, and I think if we vote for the amendment, we ought to vote down the bill. So I would urge members to vote no on the A1 amendment.
Representative Emmer, I'll get right back to you. If Mr. Andreessen moved up, if you have a very short statement on this, I would accept it. Okay, then Representative Emmer.
Mr. Chair, thank you, and Representative Simon, thank you for the kind words. I'm sure that I can get a hug later. I appreciate that. I also respect where you're coming from, but you know what? I actually handle these claims, and we're forgetting that it isn't the consumer versus the insurance company. There's another party involved in this process, and it's called the builder. And you know what? Not every builder is Krause Anderson. Not every builder is Mortensen. There are lots of small-end builders, and I'm going to give you a real-life situation that I actually handled a year ago. I had a small builder that did remodeling that could not, this builder did, could not satisfy the customer. The color was wrong, things were nicked, you caused water damage, you ripped the carpet, you destroyed my blinds. It took a jury, and it was all the way through trial, it took a jury all of about 40 minutes to agree with the builder. But you see what we're missing here by saying there's only one side to this equation and that only one party is aggrieved is that builder not only had to deal with some of the same emotions, because it's that builder's reputation within the community, it's that builder's work product that's being attacked in the court, he's also got to give up his week's worth of work to show up in front of a jury and answer the call. I think it's only fair if we can just pull out the emotional issue of whether someone's got insurance or not, because believe me, they don't always have insurance. I mean, these aren't big builders. These are people just like the consumer. So I would ask you to please support both parties that are involved in these terribly emotional and unfortunate incidents. And, Mr. Chair, I'd ask for a roll call on this.
Representative Holbrook, do you want to speak on this, or did you have a question? But we're running.
We only on a different part of the bill.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Reason would like to respond to that.
Okay, very shortly, because we're almost out of time for the question and amendment period.
Very briefly, to Representative Emmer, I guess my response would be respectfully that the small builder that you just referred to didn't have to pay your fees. And that's the point. In the couple hundred cases that I've been involved in, while we talk about small builders, big builders, whatever size builder you want to have, they are, in fact, insured. Their costs of defense, their costs to deal with these emotional issues, are covered by an insurance company who has paid a premium to accept that risk. Homeowners have never been paid to accept this risk, and they, in fact, pay out of their own pockets my bills. So while the small builder has emotional problems, if there's a frivolous claim by the plaintiffs, they don't have the financial ramifications that the plaintiffs do, and that's why in this sense, it does make sense for this to be a one-way provision and protect the consumers, which is what the warranty statute is designed to do.
Okay, we're going to go, we don't want to run out because there's another amendment in Representative Holborn. We only got about 3 minutes, so go ahead and roll call.
Chair Mullery.
No.
Representative Bigham.
No.
Representative Cornish. Representative De La Forest. Representative Emmer.
Yes.
Representative Hillstrom.
No.
Representative Hoberg.
Yes.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Kalin.
No.
Representative Coles. Representative Kranz.
No.
Representative Lesh. Representative Lilly.
No.
Representative Olin.
No.
Representative Paymar.
No.
Representative Saylor.
No.
Representative Simon.
No.
Representative Smith.
No.
Representative Westrum.
Fails 2 to 12.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Emmer.
I'm going to move the A2 amendment. This one takes out attorney's fees and says the prevailing party will be awarded costs and disbursements.
I was going to Representative Holberg. We're running out of time, and if you want to...
Mr. Chair, my question's to a different part of the bill.
But we're running out of the question and amendment period, and I don't... Since Representative Emmer had quite a bit of time, if you have time, I'd like to give you a couple minutes for your part.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, and... Representative Wills, can you define for me what pending on means? Does it mean it has to be filed? Does it mean that you're just thinking about filing a suit? Or what? How are you? Is that defined in statute? Or
pending means. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I'm not familiar with this. Mr. Chair and Representative Holberg, pending means filed. So there's a lawsuit that, in fact, and I shouldn't say filed, served. So a lawsuit has been started. So,
and Mr. Chair, then maybe we need to amend the bill to actually reflect that, if that's what their intent is, that has been served, rather than unless pending is defined in statute.
No, I think it's pretty recognized as it's going to be. That's right. It's going to be laid over if that's a problem. But I think we have a whole stack of people from the judicial system here tonight, so they're listening.
Mr. Chair, just so it's not a debatable term and that everybody's clear what exactly that it means.
Does anybody, if Representative Emmer, if you want to make your motion to...
I already did,
Mr. Chair. The A2, okay, very short description of it.
This is just the prevailing party, as opposed to prevailing party is awarded costs and disbursements, and I've taken off the attorney fees provision. And I just want to correct something for the record. Mr. Andreessen, you testified or you gave a statement earlier that, remember, the small builders apparently have someone else paying my bill. Folks, please, that is not necessarily true. I've handled both. Not everyone has the insurance that Mr. Andreessen seems to believe this deep pocket that's out there. It's the emotional issues are the same ones that the folks that are on the other side of the equation have. I'd move the A2 amendment and ask for your support.
Representative Simon, did you have a response? Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would urge defeat of the amendment, even though it's less awful than the A1 amendment. Sometimes these costs and disbursements, particularly as Mr. Seifert said, and as I'm sure Mr. Andreessen can attest to, the costs and disbursements, if you include all the studies, if you include the perhaps experts retained, if you include the survey work, and you call that, you include all of that, it's a pretty penny to most everyday Minnesotans, and I think it would still be a terrible burden. And dissuade people from seeking justice when their American dream is in jeopardy.
Thank you. Then we're going to the vote. And did you ask for roll call?
No, I did not.
Okay. Then all. I just wanted to make sure you didn't say afterwards that you'd done it. All in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
No. Amendment fails. The bill is laid over now for possible inclusion.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Galen, do you want to take the chair for the next two?
Representative Thiessen, welcome to the committee. And I understand that we're having an informational hearing on House File 1872. Is that correct, Representative Thiessen?
Oh, is this in your committee? Well, in any event, I'm assuming it would be kind of pulled into your omnibus bill if you were going to do that anywhere.
I believe ultimately we will. We will lay this over for possible consideration or possible inclusion. Excuse me. So, Representative Thiessen.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. Could you clarify what we're doing here? Because it looks like we don't have the bill in committee, and so I don't know that we can lay it over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Representative Holbert. But, we will not be taking formal action. We will lay it over at a future date for possible inclusion. That's why I included the vague future tense. We will be laying it over for possible inclusion. But so thank you for the question and clarification, Representative Holbert. Representative Thiessen, 5 minutes presentation and.
If that,
Mr. Chair.
This is a bill addressing the Hennepin County Healthcare System, Inc., which is a nonprofit subsidiary of the Hennepin County Board that operates the Hennepin County Medical Center. And it has to do with bringing clarification to what conflict of interest rules would apply. And I'd just like the witness, perhaps, to explain in a little more detail the reason we need this. And
excellent. To the testifier, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Andy Mitchell, and I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney. Our office represents both the Hennepin County Board and the new public corporation subsidiary of the Hennepin County Board, Hennepin Healthcare System, Inc., which has been vested with the authority to operate Hennepin County Medical Center, HCMC. That corporation was created by enabling a statute here in 2005, and that board was seated last summer and just began operating the hospital in January. As we've been working with the board, an ambiguity has come to light, which is that the enabling statute never specified what particular statute would govern conflicts of interest among board members or between the board and the corporation. it makes most sense, I think, to us to apply the familiar conflict of interest standard that exists in Minnesota's nonprofit statute 317A. And so this amendment, which I view as kind of a technical amendment to improve the legislation that was passed in 2005, would make it explicit that the normal nonprofit statute, which has a specific provision on conflicts of interest, would apply to this rather unique corporation.
Thank you, Mr. Mitchell. Any questions for Mr. Mitchell, Representative Thiessen? Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And from my understanding, there are some public officials on this board. Is that correct?
There are two members of the Hennepin County board that are on this board as well.
And Representative Holberg.
And Mr. Chair, why would you not hold them to a higher standard?
Mr. Mitchell.
I believe that they would continue to be held to the high standard because of their public official status as county board members.
Representative Holberg?
If you can tell me where in the bill it clarifies that or makes that exception.
Representative Thiessen.
Mr. Chair, and I think that part of what we need to do is distinguish between the actions they're taking as members of this board as opposed to members of the Hennepin County Board.
And Mr. Chair, that
Representative Holberg.
Representative Thiessen's call on it, but my call on it is if they're an elected official, no matter where they're operating or doing business, they should be held to a higher standard.
Representative Thiessen?
Well, the distinction, I think, maybe we should just to clarify, it's not just related to what their standard is, but it's, I think, how the board can operate and the decisions they can make, if I'm not mistaken. And so maybe Mr. Mitchell can explain the difference between the municipal and the nonprofit rules briefly.
Mr. Mitchell, can you attempt to do so, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will. Under 317A, that conflict of interest standard, when there is a conflict that arises, the conflicted individual can leave the consideration body, can abstain, remove themselves, and the rest of the board can vote. When a public official has a personal financial interest, then even if they abstain and leave, the contract is prohibited. I think this probably doesn't come to rise so much with the county board officials because none of the contracts between this entity and the county are contracts in which they have a personal financial interest.
And Representative Holbert, I think that this is actually an issue that we can, since it's under advisement, we can come back because I think that the county board members won't have those contracts, so we could probably structure it so it's clear that if they don't have the conflict of interest, the board can proceed and we can address your issue. I feel pretty confident about that.
And
so thank you.
That's fine. Representative Holberg. It will be laid over at some point where possible inclusion. So when we get to that point, maybe we can fix it up a little bit just to make it very, very clear that we're not letting elected officials off the hook relative to conflict of interest.
Thank you, Representative Holberg, and I'm hearing a willingness from the author to clarify that language before we ultimately, present tense, lay it over for possible inclusion. Anything else? Any other questions, committee? Representative Thiessen?
Nope.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Mitchell.
Here. Thank you very much.
We will ultimately lay it over for possible inclusion, but not tonight. Representative Mullery is next, and yours truly is in the on-deck circle. Representative Mullery, welcome to your committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Would you like to move House File 1209?
I would do so, and for layover for possible inclusion.
Excellent, Representative Mullery. And I believe...
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Mullery.
My motion is to... pass it and refer it to the Labor and Consumer Protection Division of the Commerce and Something Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, or thank you, Representative Mullery. Chair Mullery, I believe the motion will be to go to...
Commerce?
Commerce. Go to Commerce because that's
to go to Commerce next, and then they will defer. They will refer it down. Okay. 7 minutes for presentation.
Thank you.
And we'll move from there. Representative Mulready, to you, Bill.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. And the members who were here back in 2004 remember that I believe it was Representative Westerberg here in the House, and Senator Anderson, and there was a bill to stop the practice of equity stripping where people would, so-called investors, would go to desperate homeowners and then say that they're bailing them out and in fact turn them back into a rental situation that they couldn't afford the rents, and then they'd kick them out right away and take the whole property, and it was really an outrageous practice. And everyone, the governor's office got involved, the Department of Commerce, and we all stopped it. However, we found a few loopholes, and such that they can now actually put them in a different property and that they own and get around that and then foreclose them out. And there's a couple of other ambiguities in the present law, but since we're trying to get things done right away, I'd rather turn it over to the experts and let them explain it.
Excellent. Experts, welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. I'd like to thank Representative Mulready for carrying this bill this year. This bill makes does several things. It makes several technical language cleanup changes, but substantively there are four main things that it does. The first, it closes the loophole that Representative Mulready referred to, and that loophole is this. The way these kinds of deals work is that the scammer goes to the homeowner and says, you deed your property over to me, and then I will reconvey this home back to you through a contract for deed or some sort of a lease-back arrangement. The law currently only deals with the foreclosed property. So the scammers have figured out a way around that. They've said, well, you deed your house back to me, but I've got an investor that's going to buy your house, but I happen to own this other property over here. And they put the homeowner in that other property. Well, that other property is not covered under the current statute, so they can do exactly what they can't do under the current statute with the other home. So this bill will fix that and make that other property subject to all the disclosures and protections that are currently exist under law. The second thing that the bill does is direct the housing court to issue a stay of eviction upon a prima facie showing that there's a claim made under the current statute 325N. In other words, there's a violation, and that is to be adjudicated in district court. What we found is when our folks go to court, the housing courts are just simply not, they don't have the jurisdiction nor the expertise to deal with the complex claims, and so they simply say, did you pay the rent or not? The answer is no, get out. And then while the homeowner is displaced, while the claim is being adjudicated in district court, and even in some cases the house is sold out from under them while the claim is pending. So we're fixing that, just asking to put a time out and let the claim go through. The third thing it does is clarify who this law applies to. Just to fixing an ambiguity in the way the original bill was drafted, and we want to make sure that what we're exempting out is someone who's doing a favor for a friend or a relative who's not in the business of foreclosure, purchasing, and reconveying, and has a personal relationship with the homeowner. And finally, there was a sunset put on this bill 2 years ago. It's set to expire in 2009. This bill, there was a perfect storm back in 2004, home values escalating exponentially, debt mounting at the same time, creating this niche for these folks to come in and steal people's homes and equity. This bill was the perfect response. It drove the worst offenders out of the business. It allowed legitimate transactions to take place, and it provided the tools to practitioners to help aggrieved homeowners. And we think it's been a model. Four other states have adopted this very same legislation, and we think this is a perfect law that's working perfectly, especially after you fix it with these amendments, and we want to repeal the sunset. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Elwood, and expert number two.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I'm Daniel Tyson. I'm an attorney, a real estate attorney with Best & Flanagan. in Minneapolis. I'm also involved with an organization called the Equity Stripping Task Force, which is a coalition of attorneys, community organizations, members of several agencies of the state, legal aid, and pro bono volunteer attorneys. I've been a pro bono attorney for about 30 years with an organization called Volunteer Lawyers Network. I've been chair of that organization, and I've been involved with the housing and real estate areas of that organization, representing poor folks for that period of time. And I started to see some of these cases coming up under the cloak of the flipping cases, which came out in 1998, that many of us saw and I think were appalled at. But the perfect storm, as Ron Elwood's just stated, brought in a new generation, which were the equity scammers or the foreclosure rescue scammers. And we started taking on some of those cases, and we, as part of this task force, developing ways to keep the homeowners in their homes if we could, and ways to get some of the equity back. We have approximately 25 very dedicated volunteer and sole practitioner attorneys involved with the task force, and we are at the job every day. This bill will fill in the holes that we have found over the past couple of years. And this bill will carry the enlightenment of this legislature past the sunset date, which we need as well. And I wanted to mention to you that, as Mr. Elwood said, that this has been a bill which has been emulated and copied in other jurisdictions, but is also a bill which is becoming, and the issue is becoming mainstream, as in being discussed in an ABA convention coming up in a couple months. There's a session on equity scam, on these equity stripping cases, to educate attorneys around the country about what's going on. And this task force, this legislation, is out there in front, and it will be talked about. So, very proud of what you have done. We do need to have these gaps filled, and we hope that you do pass this legislation.
Mr. Chairman, just one.
Thank you, Mr. Tyson. Representative Mullery.
The Attorney General's office supports it, and Mr. Sexton, I believe, said that he talked to Representative Smith. The Department of Commerce has no problem with this bill. No opposition.
Thank you, Chair Mullery. And anyone else who'd like to testify either for or against the bill? This is your test of Chair Mullery to see that there's no opposition. Seeing no testifiers, any questions from the committee? Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just a little concerned about the use of email for this purpose. I don't know if you've ever had this situation where you send an email and like 10 days later it shows up, or vice versa. I know we're moving into that realm, but for legal and time-wise kind of things, are other states using email notification for legal purposes without any confirmation of receipt, or?
Mr. Elwood?
Mr. Chair and Representative Holberg, there is a uniform electronic, I forgot the name of that act, but there is a statute that does deal with electronic signatures and those kinds of things. And essentially what this bill does with the email provision, it doesn't require email, but it allows it, but only if the homeowner has email. That's what this is actually doing. So it's not a situation. We really tried to that was actually another loophole we're trying to close, to make sure that the notice wasn't sent by email to someone who doesn't have email. So it's actually a good consumer protection. So it doesn't require it, but it only allows it if the homeowner has email.
You good, Representative Holberg?
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Westrom.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Elwood, it's only been characterized, and I wish I had somebody in the audience who we did that was actually at least talking neutral or against this, just to hear the other side. I'm trying to think of the resident is in foreclosure. They're not going to have any place to live. Somebody comes along and gives them a deal that they potentially would have another place to live, but then they can't afford that and can't keep the payments or rent up on that as well, and then that leads to them getting evicted or kicked out, which is what's going to ultimately happen in their first foreclosure and if nothing better came along. So tell me, why is that so bad? I'm just missing something here. It sounds like these people are only being characterized as evil, taking money from somebody, but don't they have a legal contract? So if they fulfill their rent obligations in the second house that they, the second place that we're talking about, they move into, they would actually be able to have a place to live where they're going to be out on the street in a foreclosure anyways, otherwise?
Mr. Owen.
Mr. Chair and Representative Westrom, the way this bill was structured originally was to actually allow legitimate transactions to take place so that these people could, if the deal was straight and fair and honest, to stay in their homes and do exactly what you say. Yes, in some cases it is a last resort, and when these deals work, they're great. But the fixes that we're trying to do here and the protections that were built in the original bill were built in to address the situation where there never was an intention by the foreclosure purchaser, as the term of art, the equity skimmer. There was never an intention to save that person's home. The only intention was to actually steal the equity and steal the home from out from under that person. And so the bill says simply that the original bill says if the deal fails for whatever reason, that the investor winds up with 18% of the equity and the homeowner gets back 82% of the equity. So even if the deal fails, everybody is treated fairly. These were designed to deal with the unscrupulous operators that had no intention of ever helping the homeowner.
I see. Thank you. Any other questions? Then seeing none, Chair Mullery renews his motion that House File 1209 be recommended to pass and referred to the Commerce Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All those opposed, nay. The motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Representative Kalin, this bill, I believe, is for a layover for possible inclusion, isn't it?
That is correct.
Would you like to move your bill then?
Chairman, I would like to move my bill, House File 1302, for possible inclusion in the data practices.
Thank you. Representative Kalin, go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. I have a 16-page treatise explaining my bill, but I've decided to forego it and just hand it over to the experts. In essence, it's a bill to make life a little easier for our public defenders, and also that the Department of Public Safety is in agreement with. So I'll let them explain their positions on the bill and thank them for doing the work on it.
Okay, thank you, Representative Kalin. Would you state your name and...
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Robert Sikora. I'm a lawyer with the State Board of Public Defense. This bill comes to you as sort of a natural evolution of business practices in the court system. As more and more bits of information become electronic, we very carefully expand the laws to allow people access to those electronic bits of information. In this case, it's driver's license photographs. The bill that's before you now would allow criminal justice agencies, prosecutors, probation officers, courts, and public defenders to have access to those electronic driver's license photographs. Speaking for our agency, Public Defense, we currently have paper access to those documents, but it requires a subpoena and a two-day turnaround and a trip to the BCA office on East Maryland in St. Paul. The bill comes to you after having been considered by the Criminal Juvenile Justice Information Task Force, which we call sometimes Noah's Ark, because there are two prosecutors, two sheriffs, two police officers, two of everyone, up to about 37, yes, including two legislators as well. That group approved this language. It went on to the policy group that consists of even higher level luminaries in the justice system, and from that group it comes to you. With me tonight is Ms. Dana Goetz, representing the Department of Public Safety.
Ms. Goetz.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm here on behalf of Commissioner Campion tonight as chair of the policy group in support of the bill. Just to let you know, as Mr. Sikora indicated, that this bill has gone through the task force process and was ultimately adopted by the policy group, and it's included as one of the provisions in the actual TrimNet policy bill, which is in a different bill that Representative Hillstrom is carrying. So just we're in support of this provision.
Thank you, Ms. Brooks. Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to, I don't believe that there's any controversy or opposition to the bill, but just to reiterate that we really want our public defenders spending their limited resources on doing their work and not having to chase paper and visiting offices. So, I appreciate Representative Holbrook. I appreciate her co-sponsorship of this bill.
Thank you, Representative Kalin. You don't want them chasing paper like we do. Is there any discussion of this bill, or can we take a vote? Okay, then all... I'm sorry. No vote. It's laid over. This bill has been laid over. Thank you, Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Oh. No, Representative Nelson... Representative, we're changing things around so that we can, we've got a lot of people apparently from the courts, and since I get told always that the courts are way behind on their cases, I want to get them back to working.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom, I believe this one also is laid over, so would you like to move that?
I would, Mr. Chair. I move that House File 1388 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. Just go ahead and present your bill then.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm pleased to present you this policy bill for the Minnesota Judicial Branch, endorsed by the Judicial Council. This legislation provides for some administrative efficiency, removes certain administrative matters from statute, transfers them to the Judicial Council, and assists guardian ad litem and crime victims. This has no fiscal impact, according to the fiscal bill, and I ask for your favorable consideration. We do have a technical amendment.
That's what I was going to ask. Is that the A2 amendment?
It deletes Section 4, Mr. Chair.
Delete Section 4 and insert restitution on line, page 8, line 7. Is that the one?
That's correct.
That's okay. Representative Hillstrom, moves the A2 amendment to get it in the order the author wants. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say nay. Carries. Go ahead, Representative.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. With me is Chief Judge Lucy Whalen from Hennepin County District Court, and she will testify for the bill on behalf of the Minnesota Judicial Branch.
Judge Whalen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'll try and move through this fairly quickly because I know you have a lot of matters tonight. If you have questions,
thank you, Judge.
Perhaps I could answer them. Sections 1 and 2 provide for indemnification and representation of guardians ad litem by the Attorney General's Office. Guardian ad litems are either volunteers or independent contractors. The Attorney General's Office supports this proposal. There is less than one of these cases a year. So it would have very negligible impact, and generally the Attorney General is representing the state in these matters anyway. Section 3 and 5 repeals the statutory language on the salary of the state court administrator and the judicial district administrators. This is currently tied to district judges. The Judicial Council would now like to set these salaries under the human resources rules and the compensation plan that we currently have in effect for the judicial branch for other employees. Section 6 would repeal the statute on new judge expense payments. This statute is no longer necessary because we are now state-funded and the Judicial Council has a travel reimbursement policy that does apply to everybody. Section 7, this would reinstate a bail forfeiture language that was unintentionally repealed in 2006. Unclaimed bail is returned to the state general fund after a period of 6 months under the old law that was repealed by mistake. And so now we're holding it for 3 years, so this would just be to go back to the 6 months. Section 8 would remove the summons and writ of recovery forms from statutes. These are outdated forms that are currently in statute, and rather than have this in statute, the State Court Administrator's Office would simply revise these forms as necessary. Sections 9 and 10 would remove from the current guardian ad litem statute the responsibility to advise the court on child support. It currently requires guardian ad litems to advise the court on custody, support, and parenting time. Custody and parenting time would stay. The child support is not something that the guardians currently advise the court on in any event because of the complicated child support statutes in effect. Section 11 removes the directive to the state court administrator to publish inflation-adjusted child support net income caps. This is no longer relevant because of the new law that specifies dollar amounts for child support as of January 1st of 07. Section 12 permits the collection of restitution for 6 years after probation ends. This basically would give the state court administrator the option to go to collection on unpaid restitution the way we go to collection for fines, that sort of thing, revenue recapture kind of collection efforts. Section 13 through 15 repeals the statutory requirement that the state court administrator's office prepares various reports. These reports are very time-consuming. The state court administrator does not believe that they're needed or read. Any of them could be produced on request. What we're requesting is that these be deleted. The specific reports would be the court fees imposed, collected, and appropriated for the court interpreter program, the screener collector report, the report on financial consequences of policy changes made in criminal surcharge, public defender copays, use of revenue recapture, to collect public defender copay, and a list of governmental agencies that employ administrative procedures to collect fines for ordinance violations. Next, a report on juvenile delinquent filings, and finally, the report on wiretaps applied for and granted. This is a problematic report because we only can compile those reports where the information has been provided to the state court administrator's office. So those would be the reports that we would ask to be deleted as mandatory reports.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Just 1 second. I'm sorry, Representative Emmer. Did you finish your presentation?
We're all finished, Mr. Chairman.
And I have to ask if there's opposition.
Okay.
Is there any opposition? Okay, Representative Emmer, then go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Judge, thanks for coming. And I was just looking at this 62A17 subdivision 3 that you finished with, where you said the report on wiretaps is problematic because it has to be reported to the court administrator, state court administrator. Could you be a little bit more detailed about why it's problematic and why we might want to repeal it?
Well, this report, I guess, goes back to the 60s or the 70s, and the state court administrator's office issues a report that says at the top of it, this report contains only the information reported to the state court administrator's office, because it presumes that every time a prosecutor or a judge either asks for or grants a wiretap, pen register, whatever, that information is given to the state court administrator's office. So we don't have any way of actually knowing if what the State Court Administrator's Office is giving you is correct. And I guess the other question is, does anybody use that report?
Mr. Chair and Judge Whelan, well, I'm looking at Subdivision 1, and it says that that information, maybe I read it wrong, I just did it quick, but I thought it said it's required. Whoever, say if you get a request for a wiretap, you grant it, then I presume that your office reports it to the Hennepin County Court Administrator, who would in turn have 30 days under this statute to report it to the State Court Administrator. And then according to this, at the end of the year, the legislative branch, the legislature, should get a report from the State Court Administrator, which would include your wiretap order, what it was for, the information that's in here. And it sounds like that's not happening.
Well, I don't. I mean, I've never had a request for a wiretap personally, so I don't know that it happens enough that anybody is paying attention to it. I don't know if anybody's read the report. I've never seen one, so I think the theory here is that this is a report that probably isn't contained too much.
Mr. Chairman. That saves me my next question. But I'm wondering, did anybody check with the Attorney General's office to find out?
They're right there.
Do they have a position on this one way or another?
I don't know if anybody's asked them. We certainly can, if you'd like us to.
Yeah, that would be my only question, Mr. Chairman and Judge Whelan, is if they, because you even raised the question, I don't know what it'd be used for.
Right.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd be happy to check with the Attorney General's office while this bill is laid over for possible inclusion. If we need to take that piece out, we will.
Thank you.
Would the two of you then make sure that that's cleared up and get back to me on it? Oh, there's a problem? Okay. Are we ready to just lay it over then? Okay. Oh, Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Hillstrom, when the people came and talked to me about this bill, I had a question. I don't necessarily have a problem with the Attorney General's office representing guardian ad litem if they are properly trained and they're not bad actors. And so my question to them is, if we are going to provide this service, how do we limit the risk to the taxpayers and what kind of training, number one? And number two, do we have to represent them? Does the statute say we must, or is there discretion there? So if we have somebody that's really a bad actor or outrageous, can the Attorney General say no, we're not going to represent
you? Judge Weiland.
Mr. Chair and Representative Holbert, the statute would provide that the Attorney General's office would represent them. We have very extensive training programs, however, for our guardian ad litem and an evaluation process. We have a lot of extensive rules that cover complaint procedures so that in the event that there is a complaint made against a guardian, it's investigated. In fact, the chief judge reviews all of those complaints. So there are a lot of checks and balances there to be sure that our guardians are performing up to the standards that are set forth. As I indicated, there's less than one of these a year, so it's really not that this is a big problem. It's that when it does come up, these are independent contractors and volunteers by and large, and so we feel that given that and given the difficult work they do, that it is appropriate that we should provide representation for them if they are sued.
And Mr. Chair, I understand that, but one really bad actor doing one really bad deed in the name of a guardian ad litem would not be a good thing either.
Right. And Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we're certainly very conscious of that fact, which is why there are quite a few safeguards in place so that we do remove guardians if there isn't any indication that they're causing problems.
Representative Holberg, Representative Madore has a bill which is amended to specifically require a study by the Bar Association and the courts, and I don't know, I think I talked to Judge Weiland about it. I know I talked to the Chief Justice as to look at what we should be doing as far as any possible education of guardians more than we have now, and also should the courts be doing any more of a
checking on the measure. And so that study should be done over the next year.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Then the bill is laid over, Representative Hellstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
The next bill, Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee.
Representative Nelson, I've gone over with the committee, and there's nobody willing to move your bill. Representative Bigham.
Mr. Chair, I'd be honored to move House File 1230 for Representative Nelson.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Nelson, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got Ron Whitehead here with me, and I'll just do a brief introduction of the bill. Basically, this follows the theme of a few of my bills that are in this year, and it's about tax compliance or fee compliance. And this bill would give the commissioner the power to collect 9/11 fees that currently are having trouble collecting. And with that, I'll pass it over to Ron, Mr. Whitehead here. And
Mr. Whitehead.
Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ron Whitehead. I'm the Armor 911 Program Director in the Department of Public Safety. And as Representative Nelson has said, this is largely an administrative piece related to the 911 fee collection. The Department of Public Safety collects both the 911 fees and the TAM and TAP fees, so we collect that fee from telephone subscribers on behalf of the Department of Commerce and on behalf of the Public Utilities Commission. The occasion of the need for this bill comes out of the fact that the telephone industry is changing. And originally we had independent local exchanges, we had competitive local exchanges, which were all regulated by the PUC, and Department of Commerce helped administer that. We had a fairly good handle on, we knew what their customer count was and so forth. With the changing nature of the telephone industry, first wireless and now what you call VoIP providers, in large part it's been the FCC that regulates that industry. They don't file with the PUC. Although the FCC has said that they do have to file and pay 911 fees and in some cases TAM and TAP fees. What the bill would do is provide that in those cases where we don't have the ability to go to the in all cases it's technology neutral. It would allow us to question the phone company as to their fees that they're being submitted to us. And if we dispute that fee amount, then we're able to deem what we believe the fee count is, and we would do that based on some of the records that we have as part of the 911 system and turn that over to the Revenue Department for collection. If they do respond with the sworn statement telling us what the fee count is, then we still have the ability to ask them for audit of those fee counts. This, in large part, like I say, is part of our need to make sure that we're collecting the revenue due the state. The legislative auditor at one point had told us in 911 we had to be a little bit more assertive about making sure we're collecting the revenue. And I know TAM and TAP have both received that. So this would provide us with the information and the tools we need to make sure that we're collecting the 911 fee. And in the case of VoIP, which becomes a lot more difficult to regulate, it gives us a tool to request and demand that they provide the 911 fee, TAM and TAP fee, if they apply to them. And if they don't respond to us, to turn it over to the Revenue Department for collections and hopefully get them into compliance.
Okay, are there any questions? Representative Westbrook.
Mr. Chair, I forget the gentleman's name from the department.
Whitehead.
Mr. Whitehead. Refresh my memory on the court case about 3 years ago that didn't establish VoIP to be a traditional phone service and not subject to some of the 911 fees that traditional phone services were. What's the difference and what's going to give you the authority to go after that if it's not a traditional phone service?
Mr. Whitehead.
Mr. Chair, Representative Westrom, that was a case where the PUC attempted to require the VoIP providers to file as competitive local exchange carriers. That case is actually still in the court system and not been fully resolved. However, in June of 2005, the FCC ruled that the VoIP providers did have to address the 911 network, in other words, come into compliance with the requirements to have an active 911 network. And as part of that order also said that they had to provide, had to pay the 911 fees. So that, in essence, they cannot be regulated, you know, through the PUC, but in essence, the FCC has said that you do have to comply with our processes and procedures. So we're hopeful that this will provide us with the tools to make sure that they're in compliance. We have instituted some processes such as they all have to come through CLEC gateways to get into the 911 network. We have contracts and regulations that are requiring them to tell us which VoIP providers they're providing service to so that we can go at, we can hopefully get the fees that are due the state from the VoIP providers. They all have to, in large part, put their data into the database so that there's some method so the 911 system works. And again, the FCC has ordered them, gave them 120 days to make sure they're in compliance with the 911 network requirements.
I see. So, Mr. Chair, Mr. Whitehead, is there a huge back logs or unpaid amounts and arrears, or you see it's mostly prospective and just trying to tighten things up going forward? How do you see it?
Mr. Whitehead.
Mr. Chair, Representative Westrom, we honestly don't know at this point in time. In large part, it's a voluntary system, to tell the truth. And we're looking for the mechanism to make sure that we've got at least a sworn statement for the company as to that amount. I will tell you that some of the VoIP providers, such as Vonage, was the one that most of the litigation centered around, is providing us with fees. We have no way right now of asking them or demanding that they give us an accurate count of their people. That's what this statute would enable us to say. If we doubt your number count, at least an officer of the company has to give us a sworn statement as to what that customer count is for the amount that the fees are based upon.
So, Mr. Chair, last point.
Representative Weston.
It actually raises a little bit of an issue that we maybe should have a concern about, in that what if there is some prior years where the regulations or the laws weren't clear. Since rulings have come out, are we going to be going now after companies that probably didn't have it built in their rate structure or didn't have a separate line item of tax? Are they going to have to now pay it out of their own pockets? What do you envision happening? Because I'd sure hate to see some of the new consumer competition options available out there all of a sudden with us reading headlines of a $50 million tax on some company that never collected the tax in the first place from the consumers.
Mr. Whitehead, could you give a short answer since we're already, Representative Westrom, and you have gone over the contested bill.
Certainly. We would intend on going prospectively into the future. So we have no plans on going back and trying to collect years back, just looking towards the future.
Right.
Here.
Okay, that's we're going to have to move on here. Representative Nelson, your bill is laid over for possible.
And one thing here, Mr. Chairman, there's one little piece on line 2.3. After the period, the Minnesota Telecom Association has asked if we would delete after the period on line 2.3 and then delete line 2.4 and 2.5. And if somebody could amend that to the bill, that would give them a little more comfort. And
would you repeat that, Representative Nelson?
On line 2.3 after the period.
Okay.
Where it starts Bell Wireless, comma wireline, okay, and delete everything after that. And 2.3 and line 2.4 and 2.5.
Okay. Representative Nelson moves, or no, Representative Bigham moves an oral amendment deleting the last 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 words of 2.3 and all of 2.4 and 2.5. I assume there's no discussion. All in favor, say aye.
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 All opposed? Okay, then thank you, Representative Nelson.
Thank
the
you.
Bill is laid over.
Thank you.
As amended, right? Representative Morrow, looks like you have I don't imagine there's a lot of contest for this one.
I don't think so.
Thank you, Representative Morrow. Representative Olin moves Representative Morrow's bill for possible inclusion in the omnibus. Representative Morrow, would you go ahead and present your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you're having circulated now an amendment, AO70309. I was contacted by a representative from the telephone industry about one part of this amendment, so we got this amendment quickly done and wanted to get it distributed now, both to define emergency and also to ensure that the liability indemnity that in the 911 section would apply to this provision as well.
Okay, thank you, Representative Morrow. Representative Olin moves your Amendment 309 to get it in the order the author wants. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Carries. Representative Morrow, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This situation came to light when the Nicollet County Emergency Management Coordinator contacted me after the Nicollet tornado. We have the ability through software and computer hardware to make telephone calls to alert areas that a tornado is approaching, that a derailment has occurred, and other emergencies. This equipment was obtained through a Homeland Security grant and through the Department of Public Safety. Unfortunately, it appeared that Minnesota law prohibits the outgoing calls using the 911 databases that are compiled by private companies, including one that testified before the Telecommunications Committee last month. To that end, I offer this House File 1121 that would allow emergency management coordinators in our counties to make outgoing calls to notify the public of an emergency. An emergency is identified and defined on the 0309 amendment as situation in which property or public or human life is in jeopardy, and the prompt notification of the public by the public safety answering point is essential. I'd be happy to answer questions on the bill.
Representative Westman.
Mr. Chair, I know you probably don't like my hand going up. I will be brief. Representative Morrow.
Representative Western, could you speak to the microphone?
Guess you cut the microphone off.
I think somebody's playing tricks on
us. Who needs enemies but friends like that, Mr. Chair? Representative Morrow, just a question. A constituent of Representative Thiessen's has contacted me, who's blind, and he had a question about crime alerts and how could they be more informed on crime alerts. Your bill came along and looks like a sensible solution for maybe that similar concern with a crime alert where body or property could be in jeopardy. Would you be open to maybe working out some language where it would be permissive that perhaps a gentleman like that contacted me and Representative Thiessen, I believe he's also contacted, could voluntarily subscribe to a list that the police office could keep, or the emergency management or whoever, and it could work the same way for a crime alert for people that wouldn't get a posted notice or at least not know what it says on their door.
Representative Meyer, I'm not sure if there was a question. Maybe you can answer.
I can't thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Westrum, that's a very good point. I know that I had a chance to talk about that just briefly in the hallway just now with a representative from one of the other telephone companies, and I'd be happy to work with you to see if we can make that happen as well in this bill, or I'd be happy to help if it has to be a different bill. But that certainly is a situation we need to address.
Thanks.
Okay. Representative Fulker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just real briefly, I don't have a problem with your bill. I'm just wondering how this works. Does an individual have the opportunity to opt out and or opt in with, say, a cell phone number? My understanding is we're up to about 15% of the households now that don't actually have a landline.
Representative Morrow.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holbert, the situation came to me because there is a company that compiles the database that Nicollet County, Goodhue County, and other counties lease. I would be simply using that same database of phone numbers. I don't know personally whether cell phones are already on the 911 database.
but it would be all phone numbers on the 911 database as it currently exists.
And Mr. Chair, and Representative Morrow, do you know if you can opt in or opt out of the system?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holbrook, I honestly don't know whether one can opt in or opt out of the 911 system.
Okay, seeing nothing else, then thank you, Representative Morrow. Your bill is laid over for possible inclusion. Next bill is Representative Hillstrom, 1393. Representative Hillstrom, I believe this one's also for possible inclusion in the.
That is correct. Mr. Chair,
so I assume you move it.
Yes, I move that House File 1393 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And this is a department bill brought to me. It's regarding MNCOR, so I would like to turn it over to Dennis Benson.
Commissioner Benson.
Good evening, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Dennis Benson, a Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Corrections. And like everyone else, I'm going to try to be brief here tonight. Basically, this is a bill that we put together as a result of a legislative audit. And it contains a number of provisions that speak to our prison industry program that we call MNCOR. We've worked with the Department of Administration on several provisions in this bill. We're also trying to bring it up to date as MNCOR went from a subsidized program to a for-profit entity here. And it's also been centralized in the last 10 years as well. So we're handing out a handout here that summarizes the bill, but I'll go through that very quickly and briefly here to kind of give you an overview of what's included in the bill. The first provision, 16A.72, subdivision 7 and 8, adds language that clarifies that canteen funds would be deposited in the MNCOR revolving account. Canteen is the store in all of our prisons. Heretofore, each prison had its own canteen. That's been centralized now, and it's run by prison industry, so we had to make that statutory adjustment. The next provision, 16B.181, this is an area regarding the elimination of requirement that state agencies purchase products from MNCOR. It's an old state use provision that was around for several years. We haven't been using it. We believe that state agencies should be able to buy from who they want, and we bid competitively. So we've made that adjustment as well. 16C.23, subdivision 2, surplus property. This was an issue that was raised in the legislative auditor's report last summer. And basically what we're trying to do here is differentiate products from equipment or property. There was some discussion in the legislative auditor's report about how we dispose of property versus equipment, and this subdivision addresses that issue, clarifies that products manufactured and sold to the general public are not considered surplus property, so they don't have to go through the surplus property provisions in the DOA's statute. MS 241.021, this is basically the repealer of the state use. That's on the last page or the back page of the bill. It's again, it talks about the Commissioner of Administration and Corrections in a committee that used to set pricing, and they used to meet occasionally. We haven't done that in several years, so that portion of the statute is repealed. Again, this has been negotiated with Department of Administration. They are present tonight if anybody has any questions of them. 241.27, establishment of Correctional Industries Revolving Fund. Again, when we centralized industry, we went from about seven different funds out there to one fund, one revolving fund. This talks about that revolving fund. It also substitutes education for vocational. That term vocational is not in good currency anymore, so we've made that adjustment as well. And it also defines how those funds, MinCorp profits, can be used. MS 241.27, subdivision 3 and 4, disbursements from the fund, talks again about the amount of money that we think we need to carry in reserve to just operate a $40 million a year business, and it's defined as the amount of funds necessary to run this business for approximately 6 months. And then there's another provision, 241.278, agreement for workforce of state or county jail inmates. We've had a couple of occasions where we've actually contracted with county workhouses to provide additional work for our MinCorp operation simply because we didn't have the inmates available in our system. And this provision allows a way to get those funds from the county workhouse back into our MinCorp revolving account. And then in addition to that, there's a provision regarding the Community Corrections Act, and basically existing language requires CCA counties to submit financial status reports on or before the end of each calendar quarter. This time frame is not sufficient for counties to compile accurate financial information, and the bill simply changes that to quarterly to within 60 days of the end of each calendar quarter. So that's basically a housekeeping provision. As many of these provisions are, it updates the prison industry statute. It brings us into compliance with some of those areas that we got dinged on in the legislative auditor's report. And most of this, we had lengthy discussion in committee regarding the legislative auditor's report. So I really don't think there are any surprises here.
Thank you. Representative Hellstrom, I've just been informed by Representative Pamer that he needs it in his committee. So I guess the motion is changed to, your motion is changed to sending it to finance.
That's fine, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, if I could just make one last statement.
Okay.
I just, for the committee to know, I have been one of the most vocal people on what MinCorp has been up to over the years. And so the fact that they came to me and worked with me to bring this bill forward, I think speaks a lot for where we've arrived.
Okay. Representative,
Mr. Chairman, I just want to make a point. Representative Hellstrom, I'm co-author, so I do like the bill. I had a second thought, though, about the first half of the repealer that eliminates the report from the commissioner to the administration relative to the competitive pricing. So I think I'd like you to take another look at that before we get to Chairman Paymar's committee and see if we want to keep that or not. Just
happy to
talk to you about it later. Thank you.
Okay. Then all in favor of Representative Hellstrom's motion to pass and re-refer to finance, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Carries. Representative Hellstrom, you're up again. This is Representative Hellstrom night.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move that House File 131 be recommended to pass and be sent to the General Register.
Okay, Representative Hellstrom, would you proceed with your presentation? We will apparently the not the engrossed latest engrossed version is just up, and those will be passed out now, but you can go ahead and make the presentation, and the members will get it while you're going.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There is, there's this engrossed version. This is the most current form. This bill has already been to two committees, and I think we've had three or four stakeholder meetings, of which five stakeholder meetings, of the majority of which 30 or more people were present. And so this bill has come a long way. Mr. Chair, it was originally brought to me by the Attorney General's Office, and so I have Mark Ireland from the Attorney General's Office with me today.
Representative Hellstrom, with all your meetings with him and with St. Patrick's Day coming up, you should remember that name.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, it was because I've had so many testifiers here today on your committee that I just wanted to read it right.
Mr. Ireland.
That's no reflection on my status, I'm sure, Mr. Chair.
This bill does three things very quickly, and it, as Representative Hillstrom said, it's been through a number of hearings already, so I'll be brief in the description. First, it deals with the exception, which is the largest loophole. Basically, the legislature passed a bill a few years ago, and it allowed people to continue violating the law, provided that they started to violate the law prior to July 1 of 2007. And so that means that when the bill becomes effective July 1, 2007, everybody who's been violating the law gets to continue to do it. And there are a number of disclosures and things in the law, but that creates an unlevel playing field, makes it very difficult for people in the Attorney General's office to enforce the law, and doesn't give us ultimately tools at the end of the day to enforce it and people that are violating it. Second, it provides an affirmative right for people to do business with a company or a person, and even though that person is requiring them to provide their Social Security number. And then there are a number of exceptions for situations in which that Social Security number is necessary, but this eliminates the practice and allows and prohibits a business from requiring a Social Security number essentially when it's not necessary. And then finally, it I would say cleans up or modifies some of the existing language and other provisions to get at what the original intent was, which was to eliminate the unnecessary collection of Social Security numbers. People who don't need them to do their business, but nonetheless do it because it's easy. And as someone who's on the front lines of the identity theft, we hear it and we want to go upstream and just prevent the number of Social Security numbers that are floating around out there in the stream of commerce.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I'm looking at this engrossed version, I do need to make one minor oral amendment. If you look at page 2 on line 2.24, clause number 7 already has the cell provision, and so we want to delete the word cell and the comma in item number 8. Because we have it now in clause number 7.
Representative Hillstrom, would you repeat that?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. It's page 2, line 2.24. After the 8, delete the word cell and the comma.
Okay. Representative Hillstrom makes that motion to get it into the shape the author wants. All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed? Carried. Is there any further testimony?
That's it, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Is there any opponents?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, good evening. My name is Eric Ellman. I'm with the Consumer Data Industry Association. Our trade association represents, among others, the three national consumer reporting agencies, Equifax, Experian, TransUnion. We also represent employment screening companies that work with employers to do background checks on prospective employees, and residential screening companies that do background checks on prospective tenants, as well as mortgage brokers, or I should say information companies that provide the credit bureau reports, tri-merge reports to the mortgage reporting context. We have some concerns with both existing law, which goes into effect on July 1st that was mentioned earlier, as well as the bill that you have in front of you. I think there are ways to come to some kind of agreement to make the bill both workable for the proponents as well as workable for consumers and business. However, currently, because this obviously is the Public Safety Committee, we have reservations that existing law, which will go into effect on July 1st, if unamended, as well as the bill in front of you, will have some significant concerns for public safety. The proponents have a right to be concerned about identity theft, of course, and they have a right to be concerned about privacy, but we have to ask ourselves, at what cost are we, is this bill going to impose on public safety? Let's look at some facts. First of all, identity theft is down for the fourth year in a row, and dramatically so. It's down 12% from 06, from 05 to 06. It was down from 04 to 05, down from 03 to 04, and down from 02 to 03. Even though security breaches are increasing at an exponential rate, it's hardly a day goes by when you can't pick up a newspaper and hear a story about a security breach. So identity theft is on a sharp decline, even though security breaches are going up. So there has to be some kind of connection to the fact that something is happening that's right. Here's a number of things that are happening that is right. The Fair Credit Reporting Act, which was amended a few years ago, has extraordinary protection for consumers against identity theft that have never existed before. Among other things, consumers can have fraudulent information removed from their credit reports. Red flags can be placed. Security alerts can be placed on their files. Security freezes. Consumers can freeze their credit files, which is a law that you passed a couple of years ago. So clearly, some studies show that ID theft is going down, and studies have shown that there is no link between a security breach and your likelihood to become an ID theft victim. We have to look at any potential legislation that's being proposed. And the question should be asked is, what should we do? And if the answer is what we still have to do something, the answer is that something going to have an effect, a deleterious effect on public safety? And I'm afraid to say that existing law to effect on July 1st, if unchanged, and the bill in front of you will, in fact, have some significant concerns for public safety. Let me provide to you a couple of examples. Let's start with Homeland Security. Consumer reporting agencies obtain requests from and provide reports to law enforcement on a regular basis to confirm the identities of suspicious persons. For example, the New York State Department of Motor Vehicles was moving to suspend the driver's licenses of 300,000 people, many of whom were illegal immigrants, because their SSNs could not be verified. The existing law, if unamended, and the bill that you have in front of you, would again have significant deleterious effect on the ability to confirm the authenticity of a Social Security number if an SSN cannot be confirmed by a credit bureau, consumer reporting agency, or other public safety office. Airlines and airport security guards, TSA and others, these people who work on airplanes, who work on the runways, who work on the ramps, who work to screen people, all undergo criminal background checks. The inability or a reduction in the ability to confirm the Social Security number of somebody who is applying to work on our airport ramp could have significant negative impacts on the ability to protect the safety of the flying public. Child support enforcement. Consumer reporting agencies are significant providers of information from and information to consumer child support enforcement agencies. Most of this information is through the use of a Social Security number. In fact, the Association for Children for Enforcement and Support reports that public record information provided through commercial vendors, mostly using SSN, helps locate 75% of all of the deadbeat dads being sought. So, I again submit that the inability to have access to SSNs will have a significant impact on the inability to collect future child support enforcement debts. Public safety. School bus drivers, daycare centers, hospitals, all perform criminal background checks using a Social Security number. If, in fact, we are not able to collect or transmit Social Security numbers, then woe to the daycare center that hires a pedophile, or woe to the school bus driver company, the school bus company that cannot confirm that the guy applying to drive a school bus is a drunk. Lastly, residential screening. Again, tenant screening companies provide information to landlords and property managers. Generally speaking, they are trying to screen out people who are arsonists, people who have a history of burglary, people who have any other kind of criminal history. Again, the inability to use Social Security numbers would have a significant effect on criminal history and public safety. There's lots of other commercial contexts that I won't bore you with today, because obviously this is a public safety committee, but suffice it to say that if unamended, existing law, which goes into effect on July 1st, and the bill in front of you, will have significant deleterious effects on the ability to perform commerce. That concludes my testimony, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'll be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hellstrom, I
I just want to ask a question, Mr. Chair. Do you want to take all of the testimony of people and then have me reply, or what order would you like?
I was going to let Mr. Neumeister wanted to. He had contacted us, so he will have a few minutes. And then my understanding is there's nobody else from the industry, just Mr. Neumeister. Then we would let you comment and then go to our questions period.
Perfect. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. About 3 minutes or so, can you wrap? There's about that much.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Rich Neumeister. I'm opposing this bill, and I'm opposing this bill because, on one hand, there's some good privacy things, like what was described about the July 1st thing, and people aren't selling things, but let's take a look. On page 220, where it says the person has permissible purposes to obtain the individual's credit report under permissible purposes. Now, with the handout that I gave you, you'll see on those two pages.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Neumeister, we don't have a page 220.
I'm sorry, page 2, line 20 of the bill.
Okay.
It's the first engrossment as of March 12th. Okay. You'll see the number, Roman numeral I, believe, that says the person has permissible purposes. Now, starting on page 2, you'll see a lot of exemptions, almost 10 of them, under the federal statute. And one that I have some great concerns about is F, where it says otherwise has a legitimate business need for the information. So in other words, any time a person has a legitimate need for the information according to the bill, they can ask you for a Social Security number. The other part of the bill, it's on page 2, line 27, where it says the business transaction cannot otherwise be completed without the person's Social Security number. That's another broad...
It doesn't say that at all.
What line, page? I mean, what I have...
Representative Neumeister, I don't...
Oh, okay, I got this off the web.
Does anybody follow where the... Representative Neumeister?
Well, see, I got the newest version on the web. That's what I got.
Okay.
So I'm sorry.
Maybe you could go ahead without reference and somebody can try and figure out what you're talking about, but so that we don't spend a lot of time.
Page 2, line 34.
Okay. Go ahead.
See, the website's more up to date. Okay. But on the point down there, the handout that I gave you, if you take a look at the permissible purposes under the Fair Credit Reporting Act, there's about 10 exceptions to them. And the one on the second page is F. Otherwise has a legitimate business need for the information. That's a Mack truck. Someone asks you, can you please, I'd like your Social Security number because I have a legitimate need to know. Let's go now to the bill on page 3, line 3-5, or line 5 on page 3. The business transaction cannot otherwise be completed without the individual's Social Security number. Now you've got to remember, a business is going to ask, can I have your Social Security number? Now by state law, we're saying that if you refuse to give the Social Security number, we don't have to serve you. Now, my recommendation to make this more privacy friendly for constituents is one major thing. Delete number 9 completely and do something like this. The words, it's very short. Requiring consumers to furnish Social Security numbers, unless otherwise required by federal law, no person shall require that a consumer of goods or services disclose a Social Security number incident to the sale of consumer goods or services, provided, however, that insurance companies and institutions licensed by the state or federal government for financial services may require applicants for those folks to disclose their Social Security number, or disclosure may be required of a consumer as a condition of applying for a credit card for the purchase of goods and services. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I make my point. One side, you're protecting privacy. On the other one, you ran a Mack truck through. I'm saying take away some of those exemptions that the federals are asking for and what you have on page 3, line 5, and do something a little bit more limited, which I'm suggesting. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeier.
For your time.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. Representative Felstrom, you wanted to speak before we...
Yes, actually, Mr. Chair, I think that a sign that you have a good compromise is when you're getting beat up from both sides. If that gives you any indication of what we've worked on in general. I think that we have taken great strides through this process to make certain that we address the public safety needs. We have made certain to identify in the bill that if it was allowed or necessary by state or federal law to do these things, that they have that people would have the ability to take care of these very concerns that were brought up by the first test fire. At this point, I turn it over to you so that you can address all the other issues.
You have about you cut short your presentation so short that you have maybe about 3 minutes left.
We'll be brief.
Like that.
First, I think it's news to the Attorney General's office that identity theft is down. That's not our experience. I don't think that that's correct. And if it is correct, it's due to the legislation that's been passed over the past few years regarding the protection of individuals as it relates to identity theft. The reason why we're hearing more and more about security breaches than we have in the past is because so many states have passed security breach notification laws that now require businesses to disclose when they have lost CDs or laptops or other information. And in the past, I believe that there were those breaches. There just wasn't any legal requirement for them to be disclosed and for individuals to receive notice that their information had been lost. As for the public safety concerns, again, these issues were raised very early on in the bill. We've had a series of stakeholder meetings, and I believe that almost all of the subdivisions in the bill, as well as the subdivision 3, the coordination with state and federal law, provides for those specific situations that were cited in the other testimony.
Okay, thank you. Representative Holber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like somebody to comment on inability of law enforcement to use social security numbers for background checks, et cetera. I mean, my experience with Minnesota law enforcement can get their hands on pretty much anything they want if they say it's for investigative purposes.
Representative Holberg, maybe Mr. Ireland, I don't know if you have any knowledge of that. I don't
we had a
see
gentleman
anybody
to make
from
a bunch of assertions from the
I'm sorry.
The testifier from the credit agency made a bunch of assertions that we wouldn't be able to access social security numbers for law enforcement background check. I'm just wondering how that works with Minnesota state law. That
you have knowledge of Minnesota state law on that? I'm sorry. I don't see anybody else from law enforcement.
Mr. Chair.
Or Representative Felstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that was something that we wanted to make certain, and so they were all invited to the stakeholders meeting to make sure we had all of the issues on the table.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I can direct your attention to line 2.19 through 2.23. The line 2.19 represents existing law, which we feel very strongly needs amendatory language. Unfortunately, the amendatory language in 2.19 through 2.23 does not quite get us there, although we're happy to continue to work with the sponsor, as we have said all along, and the Attorney General's Office and others, to try to come to some kind of mutual understanding. But here, credit bureaus and others sell social security numbers to child support enforcement agencies to locate deadbeat dads. We sell social security numbers to law enforcement to locate fugitives, to locate witnesses, and to locate victims, among others. The existing law, let's start just there, prohibits anybody from selling a social security number obtained from individuals in the course of business. So clearly, we will not be able to sell social security numbers to anyone, whether that be law enforcement, whether that be child support enforcement, whether it be companies doing background checks or others. The bill then goes on to amend existing law to say that the SSN has to be necessary for identifying the individual. Well, conceivably an SSN is not necessary to locate a fugitive, a victim, or a witness. Theoretically, you can locate somebody without a social security number. It might take you a couple of weeks. It might take you 15 phone calls and a bunch of letters. So theoretically, an SSN is not necessary, technically, to locate a victim, a fugitive, or a deadbeat dad. And by the way, I can also point the Attorney General's office to the just recently released report about a month ago from Javelin Survey, Javelin Strategy and Research, which shows that a percentage of ID theft victims is 3.7%, down continuously, consistently, 4 years running.
Representative Hills.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One part that's actually not in the bill, but that is in current statute, Subdivision 3, coordination with other law, states that this section does not prevent the collection, use, or release of Social Security numbers as required by state or federal law, or the use of Social Security numbers for internal verification or administrative purposes. And so we believe that that takes care of it.
Representative Hulbert.
Right, thank you, Mr. Chair. If I might, question for the author. And kind of getting at what Mr. Neumeister talked about is that when you go to page 2, lines 34 through 36, you're saying that you can't disclose, or I mean, can't require a social security number in order to do business. Oh, and an exception is if there's a permissible purpose to obtain the individual's credit report. And so, and then if you go to his handout for the federal code, and it has the Mack truck that otherwise has a legitimate business need for the information. So in connection with a business transaction that is initiated by the consumer. So you say you can't make an individual do this unless federal code says you can, and federal code very clearly says that you can require it in connection with a business transaction that is initiated by the consumer.
Mr. Ireland.
Sorry, I guess I don't quite understand the question. And I think we're willing to continue to work with the industry and the various stakeholders to answer any questions that have arisen. I know that this specific provision is modeled on the other states that have already passed a similar provision or a similar statute.
No, and I understand, and this is my personal thing with Social Security numbers. It seems that every year there's a group or organization that wants to control the use of Social Security numbers, and they're going to put in this bill, and it happens virtually every year, and then they run into all the exceptions and standards in the federal provisions, and you only kind of tweak around the edges. You really don't make any big earth-shattering changes in the use or how it works, because there's the Mack truck loopholes in the federal standards. So, certainly go ahead, keep trying. But as of yet, I've seen a lot of legislation passed that really never in the end accomplishes a whole lot.
Representative Phelps.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The biggest piece of this legislation, I think, that we accomplished was to get rid of the exemption that said if you were breaking the law, you know, before this new law goes into effect, you could keep breaking the law. And so what we're saying is that you can't.
And, Madam Chair, I'm not sure that's an accurate reflection of that language that's deleted on page 3, lines 18 and 19. It says the use of Social Security numbers on or after July 1, 2007. So I'm not sure that language says you can continue to be a bad actor. I mean, the purpose of that was to give businesses a year to get their practices and their letters and their, you know, automatic spit them out notices and stuff cleared of Social Security numbers and et cetera. But I, the way I read that, it's that they had till July 1 of 07 to comply, not that if they were under the radar, they could continue to be bad actors.
Representative
Elsman. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's actually the Section 3 repealer, which had the language before that. That's not really the language isn't in the bill anymore. It's just listed on line 3.24, the repealer of Section 3. That's where it said it.
Okay, all in favor of Representative Hillstrom's motion, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say nay. Carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you.